America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By honoring your sacred vocation of education, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. At Grand Canyon University, our online bachelor's, master's, and doctoral education degree programs allow you to balance online coursework with observational and hands-on experience in the field. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at hollywoodblends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is an iconic actor who's brought us some very memorable performances in a career that spans six decades. He's perhaps best known for his portrayal of the evil yet dashing Adam Carrington on the blockbuster TV series Dynasty, for which he received nominations for a Golden Globe Award and three Soap Opera Digest Awards. But his body of work extends far beyond Dynasty. On the big screen, he's appeared in a number of great movies, including Explosion, Leopard in the Snow, The Intruder, Man of Her Dreams, Little Miss Sunshine, Poseidon, Afterburn, Aftershock, and The Experience. And on television, besides his role on Dynasty and a whole slew of guest appearances and made-for-TV movies, we remember him as Aristotle Benedict White on Ryan's Hope, Mason Capwell on Santa Barbara, for which he received a Soap Opera Digest Award nomination, A.J. Deschanel on Sunset Beach, Walter on Days of Our Lives, Preston Regis on Divinity, for which he received two Indie Series Award nominations, and Maximilian Winterthorne on Winterthorne, for which he received another Indie Series Award nomination. And on the stage, our guest has performed in everything from Shakespeare to Ibsen. He starred in The Fantastics, Godspell, King John, Love's Labor's Lost, The Imaginary Invalid, A Month in the Country, Loot, Eastern Standard, and many more plays. I am delighted and honored to welcome the great Gordon Thompson to our show. Gordon, thank you so much for being here.
Harvey, I cannot tell you, I'm honored. I'm flabbergasted, to be serious about it. I looked at the list of people that you have talked to on your show, and I thought, I don't belong there. Really, you have award winners, and I mean, multiple Emmy winners, and God knows how many. Sharon Gless, I love that interview with her. Just interesting questions, interesting people with enormously successful careers. And I don't think I'm in that echelon, frankly. So, but you've offered this wonderful invitation, and I'm being idiot to say no. So I say yes with a great deal of humility. Thank you very much. I'll shut up now. I tend to babble when I get taken aback nicely.
Well, I must tell you that I think you are very much in that echelon, and it's a huge honor to have you on the show. I know that your original career plan was to be an architect or a lawyer. What made you decide to pursue an acting career?
That architect and lawyer was, and I was a teacher in there as well. That was something I had decided I wanted to be an actor. And then I went to McGill University. I'd never acted much, I think once. That's it. I don't know where this came from. And I thought, I'm going to audition for the first show of the university season. They have a theater, sort of a group that put on plays. This is 1963 or four, three, I think. Anyway, I went upstairs and I was just shaking like a fool, really. And I'm sorry, I said, I have a term paper to write. I'm going to go. And I went downstairs. First of all, nobody has a term paper to write the first month of any term. That's a stupid excuse I gave. I got downstairs. It was raining. And I thought, I stopped. And have one of those very, very few conversations, few as far as I'm concerned, where it really was an existential conversation. Gordon, Either you decide that you're going to become an alcoholic teacher and a failure as a lawyer or an architect or something, or you go back upstairs and find out if you can do, if you're able to do what you really want to do. That is exactly what went through my mind. And I remember the feelings that intensely because it was over 60 years ago that happened. And the rest, for me, that's my history. And the next year, I went to Stratford to audition for Michael Langham, who at the time was one of the most revered and respected directors of classical theater in the English-speaking world. And I auditioned for him to be an apprentice. And I finished my audition pieces. And God spoke. I mean, this was, that was God. And he said, very good, excellent. Well, I thought that God has given his blessing, his imprimatur. It was an extraordinary feeling. And if I had not gone back upstairs and said to the rain, you've made me think, I would never have had that moment. I was very, very lucky. I really was.
You mentioned the Stratford Festival. You completed an apprenticeship in Canada. But when you returned to Stratford a few years later, you were sexually harassed by the artistic director, Robin Phillips. And when you wouldn't give in to his advances, you didn't make it into his company. And I just want to take a moment to commend you, Gordon, for speaking out and letting the world know that the casting couch applies to men as well as to women, because very few men have spoken out publicly about it.
Because it's so unpleasant. It really, really is. Robin, talented director, especially of women, but he took a huge fancy to me. And he was really revolting about it, and in my opinion. And I really honestly, finally, we took a drive in the car. I thought, okay, went to a field, took a walk. He practically threw me onto the ground in this field and threw himself on top of me. And I just told him, guy's Robin, I can't. And that was it. We drove back to the theater. And I said, Robin, I'm sorry. It's all right, darling. It's all right. He was a very darling kind of guy. And people expected me to be a part of his first season as artistic director. And I had three guys understudying me that season. I won't name them. Two were straight and married. One was gay. They were all asked back. They all complied. I really could not. Finally, what's important in the end is when the end comes, I would like to have whatever bit of integrity I've maintained still inside me. And that is more important than really anything else. It's more important than anything else I can think of. If you somehow approve of who you are as a man, as a human being, with some honor, then that's sort of a passport to an honorable existence in a way.
Well, you know, a lot of people think that with the advent of the Me Too movement, that the casting couch doesn't exist anymore. But we had a former casting director, Joel Thuram, on our show. He said that as long as somebody wants a role more than somebody else and is willing to do anything to get it, there will always be a casting couch. Do you agree with that, Gordon?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Well,
no matter what sexuality you have.
It's very distressing. You know, the first time I remember seeing you was in the 70s in Toronto at the Bayview Theatre when you appeared as Jesus in Godspell. You co-starred with Eugene Levy, Martin Short, Gilda Radner. You've described doing that show as a two-hour aerobics class with song and speech. What were your memories of working with Gilda Radner?
Gilda is one of the only two actors I've ever worked with. The other one is Linda Evans, and who, on first sight, no matter who you are, where you are, you look at Gilda and you just melt. The same thing with Linda. No other, well, Joan didn't melt looking at Linda. She was just very jealous of Linda. But Linda was deeply loved, as was Gilda. She's just, she was enchanting. She was so, she just, I'm sorry, it's impossible to describe. What you wish she was like when you saw her is exactly what she was like. Heaven, utter heaven.
I want to ask you, Gordon, whether your being Canadian has had any influence on the way you handled life in Hollywood.
Not really. No, I don't think so. Because it, as you may know, that the immigration problem still exists, I'm sure. But when I was trying very much to somehow get a visa to work in this country where I am now, it was, I remember asking an immigration lawyer, what's the problem? He said, well, the United States government has decided it is not people of Asian descent who are taking jobs away from natural-born Americans. It is Latin Americans who are taking jobs away from native-born Americans. But they couldn't say that so baldly. They said that countries in the Western Hemisphere wishing to enter the United States are going to be given very rough treatment in order to get visas and green cards. Well, the only other English-speaking country, for the most part, in the Western Hemisphere is Canada. So it was a scapegoat situation. And I'll tell you, the only smart thing I did when I signed the long form contract with Aaron Spelling to do Dynasty, I asked that the Spelling organization please to obtain and pay for my green card. It took 4 years. And I was making good money, paying a lot of taxes, employing quite a few people, and 4 years. And this man was the most powerful producer of television, practically in TV history in this country. And 4 years, that's how tough it was. It may still be, I don't know. I hope not. It shouldn't be, because Americans waft across the north, across the border. And Englishmen waft across the ocean to work in our country. I still regard Canada as my country. I could have a dual citizenship. I don't want one, especially today. If that orange person gets elected, I may have to move back.
Well, we would love to have you. You know, I know the money is better in the United States, but don't you think that in some ways, Gordon, your Canadian body of work is more interesting and more varied than your American resume?
Without question, that my resume in Canada is, coward for a year. Godspell, industrial shows. That 1 year, I did Month in the Country at the Avon Theater. Most wonderful role. Then I did, I think it was either the General Motors or the Chrysler Industrial Show. That year, three remarkable jobs. I think the most I made in Canada was $36,000, which is not really awfully good money. Actors didn't, and probably still don't make very good money. Anywhere, unemployment for the acting community is at 95% all the time. And I would like that sort of emblazoned when we see the Oscars or the Globes or whatever it may be. These are very lucky actors, everybody. There are thousands and thousands of people who are very good at their jobs who weren't lucky. The rarest thing in this business, in my business anyway, is good luck. That's the rarest thing. The cheapest thing is talent. There's more really good actors. I mean, genius, no. That's rare in any business. But decent talent, absolutely. But good luck is the rarest thing.
You know, you were the only actor that was cast in Dynasty who had not done a made-for-TV movie. And I think that your Canadian acting experience, the high caliber of your acting on Ryan's Hope, was responsible for getting you hired on Dynasty, don't you think?
Oh, yes, I do. Definitely. That took me a very long time to figure that out, Harvey. I don't know why, but it did. I thought, wow. Because, again, the links that happen, this is why I call myself a lucky man. I really was. Probably still am. ABC at the time had what they call a talent development program, which doesn't exist anymore, of course, sadly. But Tom Hanks was part of it, Donna Mills, John James, my cohort from Dynasty. I was a part of it. And so Ryan's Hope led me directly onto the ABC talent development thing, and which led directly to Dynasty, literally. And that's the extraordinarily lucky way that part of my life evolved. I was very lucky.
Well, for 7 seasons, you played the quintessential evil character of Adam Carrington. I mean, you were dazzling in your evilness in a Night of the Dark Soul kind of a way. What was the process you used to manifest and sustain that level of toxicity and wickedness in your performance?
Wow. Well, I don't know, frankly. I think I was told this. I don't think apocryphally. I think that there was a writer who was in charge of Adam for the first few scenes. And to this day, my favorite scene of all was my first scene with the woman who played my grandmother. Lorene Tuttle was her name. And I knew who she was. I remember walking onto the set to shoot this. And I thought, oh my God, wow, they're doing this up around. I was very impressed that they got this brilliant character actor. She was not quite the level of people like Irene Dunne, but she was getting up there. She co-starred, she was just under the title with Monroe and above the title in Don't Bother to Knock. She was that level of character actress. And this must have been her last job, I think. And the scene was very well written. And the fact that she was playing my grandmother just gave it a wonderful sort of bit of sauce, if you like. And she asks me to check in one of her drawers, and there's a rattle, okay? And look into the mirror. My name was Nicholas. I've forgotten my name. Michael. Michael Torrance was my name. And say, after me. And I did. Well, I'm looking in the mirror. My name is Adam Carrington. I just got a shiver down my spine. I did, really. But what happens in a moment that intense, first of all, it's very effective writing and a huge amount of information. It conveyed it to me anyway, instantly. Rage. Why did they abandon me? Why am I not up there being as rich and as spendthrift and as devil-may-care as they are? Why not? Rage, envy, a sense of I was abandoned. All that went through my mind. And I remember being at an autograph show where you signed, you know, and somebody, yeah, you know, I signed it. You seem like such a nice guy. I said, thank you. You want to see him? And he said, huh? Well, I looked at him and I summoned literally the sort of spirit of this really damaged, screwed up, very bright, aggressively ambitious person. And this guy backed away. He literally, I frightened him with what he saw. And it was only in the eyes. That's all. where most of an actor's work, at least on television and film, if you're going to do close-ups and stuff, the eyes have it. They really do.
Well, you mastered that skill, let me tell you. Were you always happy with the direction that the writers were taking for your character of Adam?
That's hard to answer. For the most part, yes. They played games with it. I don't remember a lot of the things that I've been told happened. I mean, apparently they decided I wasn't a Carrington anymore. I've forgotten that completely because that's nonsense. That's real nonsense. That's along the lines of the aliens storyline, asinine, stupid writing, as the Moldavian massacre was. That was not stupid writing. The opening of next season was a stupid writing. We emerged like from Noah's Ark, 2x2, having gone to wardrobe, hair, and makeup, looking so spiffy, the look of the show. Nobody was, Ally McGraw was done away with because Ally Devine, as she was, not a good actor. And Bill Campbell as Stephen's lover, because I don't know why, I guess because he just wasn't allowed to play the part the way he wanted to. And he's a wonderful actor. That was it. Everybody else, not a scratch. Hair not out of place. It was so stupid. It was a great cliffhanger, and they screwed it up. I'm sorry to say. But no, as far as I was concerned, I hung on to that first scene with Lorraine really for the end of my whole 7 years there.
That's a very interesting perspective for us who watched it. I really get what you're saying. Did you ever worry about your public image while you were playing such an evil, sinister character?
I didn't, no. But again, when I used to travel, for whatever reason, to do the show, to do a show or something, press or something like that, I would arrive and they had this image of who I was. And I have a friendly smile. And really that, oh, thank God, we thought you were going to be such an asshole. No. And John James, on the other hand, JJ played the prince, Jeff Colby, the prince. He butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. And if they were expecting the prince, and if he frowned, like, what's his problem? You know, geez, he's the prince kind of thing. But in my case, it was, oh, he's not an asshole, you know.
You know, Gordon, I don't quite know how to say this. I mean, obviously, you don't just have a beautiful smile, you're an incredibly handsome man. And maybe I'm way off base here, but there were times when I watched scenes that you did with Joan Collins, particularly the last few seasons, I got the impression she had a crush on you. Does that make any sense, or is my imagination running wild?
No, I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to anyway. I guess towards the end of the last season, I've forgotten the circumstance. Gordon, darling, I have feelings for you that are far from maternal.
She said that to you?
Hmm?
What did you say?
I think I just laughed. I was incredibly complimented. Joan was stunningly beautiful. She still looks damn good. And with the sexual history that Warren Beatty wanted to marry her, no. Joan has slept with some astonishing men. And the fact that I turned her on, I mean, I was not about to come out at that point. The age of AIDS was not a smart thing to do. And so I didn't. Very few people connected with Dynasty knew I was gay. Because in those days, the Inquirer was, the tabloids were, they were what is today sort of, the internet consists of the social media stuff. Well, that was around then, but it was in newspapers like tabloids, like the Inquirer. There were three or four of them. I don't remember what the others were called. But that was, and I actually, somebody did blackmail me. Somebody I was seeing years later who didn't put out, so to speak, and he blackmailed me. That's how nasty it could be. And this is long post dynasty. But again, all it would take was somebody to sneak up to the Inquirer's offices. I heard, and my career would be over.
Yes.
And it would have been.
It would have been. I think that's what Richard Chamberlain said, the same thing, that if your public image is based very much on you being a very handsome man, your female audience fantasizes about you in a romantic way. There's nothing to your benefit to come out, especially at that time when AIDS was such a stigma for all of us.
Yes. And Richard actually was, I think we've met once or twice. I liked him enormously, as who wouldn't? I'm a bit like Gilda and Linda. You just look at him and you guess exactly what you want him to be is who he is. But he got it right. I still think, I have to pay bills. I had responsibilities in Toronto and here in LA, and I can't jeopardize that. And also, frankly, what you mentioned about the fantasies and all that, that's what soap operas do. They appeal to the fantasy lives, or at least they can help build the fantasy lives that many audience members have connected with the faces that they see on camera. If it's soap opera, daytime soap opera, even prime time, because we used to do 26 shows a year. These days, 8 shows a year, maybe 10, and that's supposed to be a season. Well, not back then. 3 network, and that was it. We were around a lot more then. And so your relationship with the audience was much greater, was much more intense, because there were far fewer choices. I think when we went off the air in 89, we had still 29 million viewers every week. That's a huge number of viewers. Today, that would mean you would be the number one show practically. And Richard got it right, and I agree with him. I remember being incredibly impressed with Matt Bomer when he came out, when he got his Emmy Award. I think it was Emmy Award. I want to share this with my husband and our kids, is how he outed himself. And this is an extraordinarily handsome man who also is a very good actor. But I have to say, he wasn't the main bill payer. His husband is a very successful advertising executive, I believe, which is a great thing to have with you, behind you, helping. It was a very, very brave thing for him to do. I was knocked out.
Well, you know, I asked you about Joan Collins. I'm glad to know that my instincts were right. I had this feeling that her feelings for you were not strictly maternal. But a lot of people in the business have said that Joan Collins' personality changed when she became a huge global star on Dynasty, almost as if she took on for herself a little bit of the personality of Alexis. Do you agree with that?
Again, that's hard to say. Joan is a very good actor. People forget that. And if you want to have a look at something, she produced on the stage tonight at 8:30, a series of one-act plays that Noel Coward wrote for himself and Gertrude Lawrence. Joan mounted that in London in the West End. Joan Collins Company presents Noel Coward's tonight at 8:30. And it's on video if you want to have a look. And the range she displays is wonderful. So she's always had the gift. She's a gifted woman. John Gielgud said to her, this is in a BritBox special, I think, documentary on herself. Darling, I'll never accept you, said Sir John to Joan. And the reason is because she's so beautiful. She just movie star gorgeous. So she had that facing her when she set out. And I didn't know her before Dynasty. She's a wonderful hostess, which I think is always very indicative of a certain kind of giving, sharing individual. She's a great hostess. And maybe it's a great part. And as a very talented woman, she could see what a good part it was, and she wiped the floor with it. She just went to town and established herself as the star she'd always wanted to be, and conceivably, maybe part of Alexis, she leached into herself. I don't know. We're all capable of being that way at various times in our lives. But I don't think, in my experience, it happened that much or as much as people have said it happened.
That's good, because I don't like the thought of an actor confusing themselves with the characters they play. But I did get the feeling that in real life, Joan resented the love that the public felt for Linda Evans. You know, we had her on our show, and I must tell you something, Gordon, even over Zoom, there was something angelic about Linda that came through on the screen that mesmerized me. She's like a human ray of sunshine.
Hey, remember being asked to describe Linda, and I came up with, she's like the sun coming up, like dawn, the sun's coming up. That's Linda. And that's exactly who she is. She's that glorious. And she's that positive. She's just a remarkable individual. Good for you.
You know, she told me that John Forsythe was the most professional, kind, and wonderful person she'd ever worked with. A real gentleman. Did you feel the same way about him?
Yes, we all did. John, I think since then, several of us have been sort of the head of a casting, sort of the head of a show somewhere for a little while. Anyway, Jack Pullman and Harold Heroes, for instance. And it's very important that there is one person, as a rule, who sets the tone of every set you work on. If it's a movie star, it's Julia Roberts, she sets the tone. In this case, it was John Forsythe. He set the tone. So if the leading man, the star of the show, is there for off-camera lines, so if he's doing it, you goddamn well to do it yourself. Nobody's going to get away with it. Nobody's going to arrive at work unprepared. And nobody ever did, or rarely. I can't remember a time when somebody got work unprepared. John, utter professionalism. His flaw was he didn't, and I don't know, maybe I'm not sure his ego or what it was. He didn't care for Joan, and she didn't care for him. She's called him a misogynistic prick. He wasn't a misogynistic prick. He just didn't like Joan. That's all. That's all. And I have a feeling that the effect she had on Dynasty, Aaron himself said to her point blank, "You saved my show." Well, that right away puts down being actor, in that case, John, and actress Linda, "You saved my show." Well, you shouldn't have said that. We're within hearing of John Forsythe. You know, it's a deal, but that's ego. That's just ego. That's all that is. But he was everything you've heard about him, that Linda said about him, is absolutely true.
Now, Gordon, you did not appear in Dynasty, the reunion, because you were filming Santa Barbara and no one bothered to see if they could arrange your schedule so you could be in the reunion. I know you sued Aaron Spelling over that, which was a very drastic step to take. Did you agonize over that decision to sue him?
No, not really. There was no effort made. The actor they hired, he has sadly died since between now and then. They hired him because he could wear the clothes. That's all. And I was really insulted that the lack of respect they showed, that's my being an idealist, I suppose, and being really not tuned into whatever cutthroat aspects there are in this business, or were then, maybe still are. the casting couch syndrome that we talked about earlier? I didn't think about it much. When I told Don James and Jack Coleman recently that you sued Aaron? As in, you blazing idiot. He would hate. Yes, and I'm sure he did. And I didn't. Well, I did work for him finally once again. I think he produced a daytime soap called Sunset Beach. And his son Randy was in that. So he forgave me, at least to that degree. But it was probably a very stupid thing for me to do. But I was angry. I really was. I thought, pick up the phone, call NBC, who was producing Santa Barbara, and see if something can be worked out. I don't work every day all day. I work every day, but not all day. But there was no attempt. It was the sort of thing. I remember being nominated for a Golden Globe for Dynasty, as was John James. And the category was very stupid. And the spelling office took out a whole page about the nomination, but not me. It was Dynasty, blah, blah, blah. I was lost. And I had the worst management, I think, in Los Angeles at the time. That are there any along with us as well. I thought, well, why didn't you come to me? We could have produced a page in Variety or something, or the Hollywood Reporter. They're not that expensive. And to congratulate our client, Gordon Thompson, as getting this nomination. By the, No, they didn't. And Aaron didn't either. And for some reason, that's, again, I think that's pretty shitty pool, basically.
Yeah, I agree for sure. What did you think of the 2017 reboot of Dynasty?
Crap. I didn't see that. I saw not much. I saw enough. I was actually quoted in the New York Times because they actually wrote about it. And Gordon Thompson calls it an abomination. Quoted I was. Well, it was. And it was, I don't know what they were thinking. If there's an afterlife, Aaron would have been rolling in his grave. Nothing met the production standards, the writing, the casting, the acting. There was one promising performance. The woman who played Fallon, I don't remember her name. Very good. Everybody else was crap. And I remember Heather saying, well, every generation deserves to have its own dynasty. I said, yes, I agree, but it has to have the same production standards as we had. When I finally met Linda Gray at a screening of a web soap opera, I think it might have been Divinity, I'm not sure. Linda was also in that. And it was lovely to meet her. She's just heaven on a stick. And we told each other, I said, we had the most wonderful director of photography. He said, yes, she said, we were so jealous of that. What we were jealous of were the Dallas scripts. They lasted a full 3 or 4 years longer than we did because the writing was so much better. And that didn't have to happen. The writing on the Da Dynasty reboot was execrable. Really, it was. Everybody was much too young. CW, really? Okay. They have not a clue.
Now, Gordon, over the years, you've worked with a lot of great actors and actresses. I'm wondering who are the ones that you feel you've learned the most from?
Really? Maybe Kate and Franny, for the reasons I've told you. But after the apprenticeship period, which lasts many years. Not many. I know what I'm doing. And I've worked with very few geniuses friends of mine have worked with Meryl Streep, for instance. Now that would be, wow, an eye-opening experience. I remember working Leopard in the Snow, which was the first and sadly only Harlequin romance that was filmed. Kenneth Moore, Billy Whitelaw, and I was playing a sort of Hooray Henry character in the thing. I'm Canadian. Pierre Delay was part of the Canadian contingent. It was British-Canadian produced. Pierre Delay is American. He has an address, or had an address, in Toronto, so this allowed the unions to finesse him into the Canadian part of the production staff. I actually was Canadian, playing an Englishman, which was lovely. And Billy Whitelaw, sort of, she wasn't, she very good, but I sensed the sort of, you know, what are you doing here, sort of thing. Yeah. You're not really British, are you? You know, I sounded it and I looked it, and that was enough for the producers and director. I had a lovely time in London. I loved it. And I just proved something that, you know, the flood of the Brits flooding into Canada. Well, there's one of us at least going back the other way now. Thank you. This is for a lot of people who would like to be in my shoes.
Have there been any big stars you've worked with who disappointed you by their unprofessional behavior?
There have been. And I've been so lucky. I have gotten along with almost every actor, every crew member I've ever worked with in any medium, seriously. Two women, very beautiful, very successful. And I'll tell you one of them, Leslie Ann Down. We did Sunset Beach together. And we had very little together. We were ex-husband and wife. And there was a post-coital, one of our very few post-coital scenes. And the makeup artist came into the final touch-up before this huge close-up of us. And dab, dab, dab. She said, "You both look so beautiful," and left. Well, that was not the thing to say. Leslie Ann was raised in her teenage years with the billing, Britain's most beautiful teenager. What an awful thing to say and to celebrate. How awful. That's how she grew up. And she was gorgeous. She was bright. She was a good actor. Well, the worm turned. Suddenly, she really, really began to, I dislike me intensely because of that remark. She was viscerally offended by the fact that I was nice looking. And at one point, I think this is true. In the days when lots of soap operas, the dress rehearsal is broadcast on all the network monitors in every office. So if anybody's paying attention, if they may be, who knows? And my character had settled down with the brilliant actress Kathleen Noon, who played Cousin Bet on the show. Fabulous. And she and I finally getting together. And Leslie Ann, her close-up, had a line, "Oh, AJ, I never thought I'd see you settle down with just one woman. Oh, AJ, I never thought I'd see it settle down with just one woman." That's how she said it, with the look in her face. She basically outed me. And in 1999, not a terribly good time, even then, to be outed. Thank you very much. That is, you fill your favorite epithet. Mine rhymes with bun. It's just, I mean, appalling. Appalling. Just, why? Be so. I remember I left the set. I went to the control booth, and my good friend Lisa Picazot was producing that day. She said, "What?" I said, "Honey, I don't know." It was just meaningless, and it was very, very unpleasant.
Well, it was vicious.
Yes, it was. deliberate, vicious.
You know, Gordon, you're one of a handful of actors who have moved quite effortlessly from primetime TV shows to daytime soaps. By my count, you've appeared in 7 daytime dramas: High Hopes, Days of Our Lives, The Young and the Restless, Passions, Santa Barbara, Ryan's Hope, and Sunset Beach. How do you like the fast pace of doing soaps compared to primetime TV shows?
I loved it. I have to say, Santa Barbara had, they, when they, I was in my prime physically and mentally, and it was a wonderful role. And they fed me a lot of pages early on. And when it became clear to the writers, and I know one of the writers quite well these days, good man, nice man called Gary Tomlin, they thought, okay. They threw 35 pages a day, 5 days a week, for over 2.5 years. And I thrived on that, really. It was the best writing I've had in front of a camera. And I loved it. And I still do. I still do.
Well, you were the third actor to play Mason Capwell on Santa Barbara after Lane Davies and Terry Lester. When you took over the role, did you feel any pressure to play the character the way they did?
No, because I hadn't seen. I don't like watching myself. I don't watch much television anyway. And I'd never seen Santa Barbara. I was called in by the then executive producer. He didn't last very long. And here's the job, and here's the money. Okay, fine. The end. No. Lane, I gather, was absolutely wonderful. He got an Emmy Award for it, at least one. Terry, I know, didn't like doing it, and that's the reason why they've had to find someone quickly. He was on, I think, only for 3 weeks, I think. So it's really just a hiccup between Lane and myself. Lane had an extraordinary contract. His love in life is Shakespeare, and he insisted that along with playing Mason, he would have time off every year to do at least one Shakespeare play. Very smart thing to do, to keep the classic juices flowing. I've never met him. I've never seen his work. But I do know his reputation is very, very high. Very.
You know, many of the veteran actors like yourself that I've interviewed have told me that when they look back at the success they've had in their careers, they believe that luck played as big a role as talent. And you've mentioned luck in this interview. Do you feel that luck played as big a role in your success as your talent?
Without question. I really want to win an award because I'm going to say this. Helena Bonham Carter has already said it when she got her, I think, BAFTA award for The Crown.
She played Princess Margaret, that's right.
Yes, right. And with that wonderful limerick, she said, basically, she's been very lucky. But there are actors out there who are so good, talent, as I've said, is the cheapest thing in the business. There's so many gifted. Not, as I say, it's not geniuses, they're rare anywhere. But there are really good actors around. And if you're not, I mean, if Julia Roberts had not been born in Smyrna, Georgia, if she'd been born in, I don't know, the Yukon, same face, same body, same woman, she could not have been allowed to work in the U.S. as a Canadian performer. Goodbye. One of the most remarkable debuts in modern cinema, really. No, again, going back to The Collector, which I did for Michael Caruso, playing the Dachau person who helped to liberate the prison. I worked with 3 terrific actors. They said, "Well, Gordon, you're old Hollywood." I thought, "What?" Well, I guess I am. Because with me, all Hollywood means Irene Dunne, Cary Grant, Spencer Tracy. It means the 30s, and that were the greatest movies I probably ever made in this country were made. You see, but I'm old Hollywood now. 40 years ago, yet when I was Dynasty, three networks, that's old Hollywood, I guess, if you're new Hollywood. And two of these guys were new Hollywood, very young. People who work for Ryan Murphy, for instance, that's new Hollywood.
You're too young to be really part of the golden age of Hollywood. But yes. Getting back to the issue of the luck, there's certainly no disputing the fact that you were blessed with the good looks of an extremely handsome leading man. It's no secret that you were a major sex symbol for many years, especially on Dynasty. But were there times during your career that you felt typecast because of your looks?
Oh, yes, without question. They don't help as a rule. And that's one big reason why the demise of 14 daytime dramas, it's not just the actors, it's the crews, it's the writers, producers. Hundreds of people lost their jobs per loss of daytime soap opera, not just the actors, but the actors in daytime almost by law have to be good looking. And it's not useful. For most actors, it really isn't useful. In Canada, certainly not. Again, I don't know, I did Importance of Being Earnest, for God's sake, in Sudbury, the nickel capital of the world. I'd do Importance in a bathroom, I guess, a wonderful play to do. But that's most of the work was in spite of what I looked like. And it's not an advantage. It's just DNA. That's all it is. And I actually, small story about something I auditioned for about 6 weeks ago or 2 months ago. Ted Danson has a new half-hour comedy. I don't know what it's called. I think it's like The Man Inside or something. And he plays an investigator who's been called in by people who run an old folks home. Because there's been elder abuse has been reported. So Ted Danson has been hired to do this job. And a wonderful casting director called Allison Jones asked me to come in and read for one of the inmates in the old folks home, age 75 to 85, and come in. And we're not just putting you on tape. It just usually it's you to send in yourself tape these days, which is really dreary. This was in front of herself, Allison, the executive producer, writer. There were five or six people in the room. So you have an audience to play to. And her instruction on the audition page was, don't try to be funny. I said, okay. I'm also don't try to be caught. Don't be caught acting was my note to myself. So I worked very hard on it, and I did a very good job, and they were very encouraging and pleased. There was no interest at all because they had their leading man. I still look like an older leading man. They've got Ted Danson, who's been a leading man for far longer than I have, or whatever, and they have him. They don't need another one of those. They hired a man called John Getz. I looked him up, of course I did. And I thought, that's a wonderful face. There's not a trace of leading man looks there. He's got it's just a great expressive face. Sally Struthers is playing his girlfriend. That's wonderful. Oh, I would have loved to have done that. But this, in that instance, this was not useful.
It's distressing because the public likes it. So I'm not sure that those casting people are all that smart because I've never heard of a complaint about too many good-looking people in a show. But I'm going to move on. You know, you touched me very deeply when you talked about not coming out and how difficult it would have been. It would have been career suicide if you had come out back in the 80s. And it's well known, Gordon, that you were outed by a very unscrupulous interviewer from the Daily Beast. My question to you is, do you think you would have come out eventually if you had not been outed?
That's a very good question. I've asked myself the same thing. I don't know. I hope I would have the guts. I don't know. That's what I wish I could know. Elon Musk has a sister called Tosca Musk. She produces love stories, basically. And since I've come out, her company was interested in my availability, but they didn't pursue it. And I think that's an example of homophobia affecting hiring. We got along well, but I want to keep working. Thank you very much. I wish, this is one reason I was so angry that this person whom I refuse to identify, that he asked me on a date at the end of this, by the way. He actually asked me out at the end of our interview. He asked me out.
Now, that's what you call, in Yiddish, you call that chutzpah.
Yes, isn't it, though? I thought, you nitwit. That's an ambush, which I resented hugely. His first question was, and it was about, the situation was, they're producing the boxed set of all 217 Dynasty episodes. And to do the PR for this, they asked Pamela Bellwood Wheeler and John James and myself to do interviews to just publicize it. And this guy, how are this going to publicize Dynasty's box set, you idiot? Well, Gordon, as one gay man to another, and I thought, I have those really instant conversations. How do I proceed? Do I hang up or do I simply say continue? I chose to continue because to hang up would have been a big coup for him, kind of a gotcha, which I was, all these things, the way I told you how I responded to Loreen Tuttle's question, to say after me, my name is Adam Carrington, very fast image with this asshole, very fast. We'll continue. But I'm not going to have dinner with you.
Certainly not, no. Well, I think the answer to the question, would you have come out anyway, is connected to the question, were you suffering a lot during those years when you had to remain in the closet?
No, I was not. I was not. I had very good friends, not lots and lots, but enough very good friends. I lived in a very nice house I was able to buy and live in for a while with a pool. And I had a boyfriend that was a big mistake, that was about as platonic as a relationship can get, which is really boring. But that didn't bother me all that much. I had my coterie of friends and I had my work. And I had a good income, and I was doing myself proud in lots of ways. And I did as much to support the cause of AIDS, short of coming out, as I possibly could, as I had to. I had friends who died. And it's just, there's a wonderful book by a dancer who was in a chorus line. Her name is Christine Barker. The book is called Third Girl from the Left. It's about her brother and her brother's lover, Perry Ellis. And she's very, very, very good at expressing what it was like, what the AIDS crisis was like in New York, in this business, while it was happening. Because she had a ringside seat. And her parents were very conservative. She wasn't. She was an artist and a dancer. I recommend the book without reservation. It's really good. But those are the things I did. I guess if I had a conscience, and I didn't really, it was either that or, you know, commit professional suicide. No, thank you. I've never felt like doing that.
No, and why should you? Why would anybody expect you to? Now, I know, Gordon, when you've been asked whether you intend to write a memoir, you've always said no because you don't think you're interesting enough. Well, what would it take to convince you that you are extraordinarily interesting and that you should write a memoir?
Oh, I don't know, Harvey. I really don't. My memory isn't all that great. I mean, going back to, you know, I have a picture of my brother and me. I think I was, who, when Peter was probably 8. And somebody asked, could I have a picture of you before you became well known? And I sent them that picture, me at 2, which I thought was very funny. But I don't have, I have a brother and a sister. That's it for immediate family. My brother has 2 daughters. He has a granddaughter. I have a cousin I couldn't stand when I was growing up. I still can't stand her. And she sends a lot of emails that I ignore completely. She would probably be the best source, if I decided to write a memoir, of my childhood. But she stands in my way for all kinds of reasons. She's a bully, is what she is. Anyway, I don't think I have the energy. I really don't. I have quite a bit of energy, but to go back and delve into all that, oh boy, I asked my manager about that. She said, well, you don't do the writing yourself. You hire someone to write it, and you just put it on tape, basically. When they just like taking dictation. Say that quickly, taking dictation. Well, okay, I would have to co-write it at some point. I like writing and I'm not bad at it. I just think I'm not that interested in myself. It's like watching myself. I hate it. I remember seeing Maggie Smith interviewed about this very thing. And she said, well, you know, on stage, if something goes wrong, you have the next performance to fix it. But if it's on film, it's frozen. And you can say, oh, well, I wish I could do it again, and let's get a facelift. That's how I respond. That's how she responded. I couldn't agree more. I haven't got much in common, Dame, with Dame Maggie, but that's one of the things I've got in common with her. I agree completely.
Well, I've only got one more question for you. Are you ready?
Yes. Oh.
I'm dying to know, what was it like playing Sir Robin the Brave with Kermit the Frog? I loved you doing that. I loved it.
Thank you. I did. That was you. What a lovely question to ask. That was the job that was the most magical. We did it. We taped all the music. They taped my song at 3:45 in the morning, Robert Lawrence Productions in Toronto. I was one of two human, Trudy Young was the other human being. And Jim Henson was, and his Muppeteers, they were incredible. The crew was, then at the end of the show, the palace balcony, there's Trudy and there's me and there's on the balcony, there's Kermit sitting right next to me. And down below the wall, there's Jim Henson working Kermit. And this is my new best friend. And believe me, they become completely real. And we sing this anthem. Anthems of joy, we sing. And my favorite thing, they call me Sir Robin the Brave, and history one day will rave. I'm valiant and daring and noble of bearing, courageous and gallant, a mountain of talent. No wonder folks curtsy and wave. I'm Robin, Sir Robin the Brave. Just heaven on a stick. The best time. Like, I could not have asked for a lovelier job to do. It was magical. It really was.
I can't think of a more magical, lovelier way to end this interview. I got you to sing that song. I'm so thrilled. It's been such a pleasure meeting you, Gordon. I've loved you a long time. I respect and admire you so much, especially your integrity. And it's been a great thrill to celebrate your wonderful career on our show. Thank you for taking the time to appear on our show.
Thank you for the invitation. More than I can tell you, I repeat, I'm honored. I really am. And thank you. So I had a good time. I had a very good time, Harvey. Thank you very much.
I had an even better time. Our guest has been the great actor, Gordon Thompson. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.